evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Joan Jacobs Brumberg. Brumberg is a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow and Professor at Cornell, where she teaches history, human development, and women's studies. She is the author of two groundbreaking books about girls, including Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia Nervosa, and The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, which we are going to discuss this evening. Welcome to the show, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, as a historian, you could have focused on many different arenas. Why did you choose adolescent girl history and women's history?
Well, I think, in all honesty, I was never that interested in tariffs and in wars. And when I got the social history bug in the 1960s, I think it was related to my personal politics at that time, the idea that history should be written from the bottom up rather than the top down. And in that, also in that mix, was a kind of blossoming feminism. Mm-hmm. And women's history, or kind of the newest incarnation of women's history, was really born out of the politics of the 1960s and early 1970s. Mm-hmm. But I got interested in girls. I mean, I was just interested in the adolescent experience. I had a dissertation advisor at the University of Virginia who was interested in adolescence, but I could tell it was strictly male adolescence. Mm. And so that provoked me to be interested in the personal materials generated by adolescent girls way back into the 19th century. Mm-hmm. In other words, their diaries and letters. And, mm-hmm. and once I started reading those, I just got hooked mm-hmm. on girl history.
And the Body Project examines the way social change over the last century has affected the ways in which girls perceive their bodies and think about themselves. Talk about some of the cultural shifts that have happened in the last century.
Well, the largest one, and the one that, you know, my editors encouraged me to make into a great soundbite, so I will repeat it, is that in the 19th century, girls in their diaries were concerned primarily about good works. Beginning in the 20th century, I usually date this to about the time of World War I, you begin to see and hear girls who are more concerned about good looks. So that shift from good works to good looks, mm-hmm. is the important.
Surprised it started that early.
Well, I mean, actually, if you think about it, there are many social and economic changes, many technological innovations in the early 20th century that increase people's level of self-scrutiny. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything from things like the availability of mirrors, you know, looking glass. A looking glass was something that one found in the home of the wealthy, you know, at the time of the Civil War. By the end of the 19th century, there are more and more kind of handheld mirrors available at Sears mm-hmm. and Roebuck, and they're mm-hmm. cheap. And, you know, by the 20s, you have compacts.
Yes.
You know, so women can look at themselves on the street and adjust their makeup. And movies are very important. And, mm-hmm. oh, the availability of places to weigh yourself and electric lights and running water together in a modern bathroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about a place for adolescent girls to start, you know, really examining themselves.
Uh-huh. And you talk about how in your book about a century ago, girl culture was rooted in family, community, and school, and now it's directed sort of in a commercial focus.
Well, that's absolutely one of mm-hmm. the very large kind of social and economic changes that underlies or girds this change from good works to good looks. In the 19th century, the culture of women and girls was still very much single sex. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of ways in which generations of mothers and daughters and aunts and collateral kin were linked to one another living in the same community. Our family structures have changed. Mobility is part of this story, but also there's been an unrelenting commercial sell mm-hmm. To adolescent girls, you know, beginning with innocuous and relatively benign things like here's a soap that's going to make your face pretty, mm-hmm. Prettier, to, you know, the kinds of things that we get today where we have 16-year-old girls who want plastic surgery for a birthday present.
That's absolutely unbelievable to me.
Well, it's not uncommon.
I know it's not.
I mean,
not.
The in terms of, I mean, one of the themes in my book is that there's been more and more pressure for a perfect body, and therefore the number of body projects has escalated and intensified. Plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery is certainly part of that. Mm-hmm. And that's the fastest growing, these procedures in cosmetic surgery are the fastest growing piece of American medicine right now.
It's amazing. How did you do the research for this book? I know you read girls' diaries.
Oh, yeah, I read a lot of diaries.
What else did you do?
Well, I, you know, tried to read letters. I also, by adolescent girls, I read advice books to parents. I read medical texts, published case reports as well as unpublished case reports. Mm. I read newspapers, and I also read a hell of a lot of 19th century and early 20th century novels and women's magazines, you know, to see what the stories were, the formula stories that were embedded in the minds of young women at those different points in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually have a collection of those kinds of books.
Ooh, I love those.
I'm sure you would have been interested when you were writing the book. I have two huge boxes of books about how to be a lovely girl.
No, I'd love to see those.
I almost brought them, but it was absolutely
I might make a little plea right now that you think about donating them to the Cornell Library
That's
at some point.
That's a possibility.
You know why?
It
is an interesting point. I mean, so much of girl history is rooted in these kinds of things, these kind of texts, books, magazines, mm-hmm. that people throw away because they think they have no value.
Yeah.
And the same is true with girls' diaries. There's this sense that this is, you know, an emotional gush from a silly little girl.
Yeah.
Therefore, chuck it when the family moves away to Florida Sun City, Arizona,
or I was reading your book, I thought, what happened to my little green diary that I used to have? Obviously, it got thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I started saving those kinds of books as a person in the feminist movement. I wanted to save the history of what we had transpired.
I once put an ad in the New York Times book review in the letters section. Do you remember when they used to have that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And this was in 1982, and I advertised for diaries written by adolescent young women ages 13 to 18 in the years between 1830 and 1982.
Hmm.
I was deluged.
Really?
And it was very interesting. I actually had to ask the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe College to help me deal with all the responses. There's a very deep tradition of American girl diary keeping, and yet it's interesting that we've only begun to consider these as real historical texts mm-hmm. in probably the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you find out about class differences in regard to these body projects that women end up their journeys on?
Well, that's a really good question. Just as today there are class differences in body projects, for example, I think working class women may in fact spend more time and energy on their nails. I mean, if you think about nail culture, I mean, if you go to the supermarket, there are an awful lot of women working behind the cash register who have quite glamorous and interesting decorated nails of all kinds. So, you know, while wealthier women may pursue Botox, you know, they're age-specific, they're class-specific. Generally, the kinds of diaries that I worked with tend to be middle and upper class, and that's because working class women and girls just don't have the same amount of time mm-hmm. or privacy to put into that kind of expression. But having said that, I didn't know as much about their body projects in the past. And yet, one of the things that's apparent to someone like myself who is a social historian is that something like the hat in the early 20th century was a really important marker of social class. And so you'd have immigrant girls, ethnic girls in the city of New York who would invest an enormous amount of their income in decorating and fashioning hats that would attract attention as they began to spend more and more time on the streets, in more public social settings, as family life, you know, within, particularly in a tenement house. I mean, there's not a lot of space for socializing, and so you're outside, and so the hat becomes very important. And there's a lot of writing, in fact, about girls and their hats in the early 20th century. So that's kind of one answer to your question. These were still girls who These are girls who are beginning to think of their appearance as a marker of their attractiveness, their sociability, and so the hat becomes very important to them.
That's interesting. You talk about how not only has the culture changed, but girls' bodies have in fact changed. Girls nowadays get their periods much younger than their grandmothers and great-grandmothers
did. That's right.
How is that reflected in these body projects?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of human experiences are happening earlier now than before. Girls menstruate earlier now than they did 150 years ago because of affluence, because of improved nutrition, and the decline of infectious diseases. It's a combination of those two. And you have to have a certain amount of adipose tissue to begin to menstruate. So, you know, what this meant initially was that there was a lot of medical attention to the issue of menstruation and its meaning in the early 19th century. In a way, there was an ovulatory revolution in that more and more women were getting their periods earlier in the 20th century and then not bringing all of those cycles to fruition in a pregnancy. You know, today we have girls who are menstruating even earlier. I think the average age now is just about 12.3.
Mm-hmm.
What it means, if you think about it, is, you know, you are menstruating before your great-great-grandmother. You know, it's just such a big difference, and you're also probably not marrying until much later, and so the whole issue of your sexuality from the get-go is more complicated. This early menstruation is certainly not a signal that we want our girls to be sexually active.
That's
at
right.
12.3. So we should be thinking about some protective, and I don't mean intrusive and punitive, I mean real protective, intelligent, educational strategies for girls. And also, I mean, anybody who's listening to me, don't think that the age is going to go down to 9. I mean, my understanding is from asking endocrinologists and experts on the field that, you know, there's a floor here. You know, some people also, by the way, throw in the existence of estrogen in the environment,
and
in milk, and
right.
in, you know, the meat that we eat as another possible precipitating factor.
I have known an inordinate number of girls who've started menstruating at 9 or 10, which I had never heard of when
right.
I was growing
it's
up.
It's still unusual.
Yes.
I mean, but the outliers are different now. In other words, the other thing that I think is really interesting about all of this is here we are talking about this early menstruation on the radio. I've asked the question repeatedly, what about earlier first ejaculation in boys, and people kind of like their eyes glaze over.
I wonder why that is. They're embarrassed by it.
Boys don't talk to their parents as easily as girls will. I mean, parents expect, you know, they're on the lookout. They know the signs when a girl is going to menstruate early. They're not sure with a boy. And then, of course, the other reality is, and this kind of underscores a point in my book, and that is that menstruation has a commercial expression in the purchase of sanitary products. And the interesting thing about the market research on that is that the bond that a mother and daughter make around that first purchase is a really important thing for the sanitary products industry. In other words, most people stick apparently with the same products that they introduced to when they're young, and most American girls regard menstruation as a crisis of hygiene.
I was just going to bring that up.
Rather than a maturational event.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. And also, Victorian medicine thought women's ovaries were much more important than their brains.
Oh, absolutely.
In regard to higher education could damage a girl.
Going to a place like Cornell was a really bad thing for your ovaries. because co-education was the worst thing, you see.
Right.
Educating a woman like a man in the same way was thought by a lot of very, very powerful doctors, well-known doctors. These were not, you know, crackpots, to be something that would draw energy away from the ovaries to the brain and therefore leave you fragile and possibly infertile. And but that, again, you know, the historical thing that's so interesting here is that this is a theory about limited energy. It was a scientific principle or a biological principle at that time.
Girls were
frail.
They
applied the same thing to boys.
Ah.
So masturbation, for example, was a bad thing because you'd be expending sperm in a non-procreative way.
So in some ways, religion came into it as well.
Oh, religion usually, yes, usually comes into these things about adolescent sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Joan Jacobs Brumberg, a historian and professor at Cornell University. You conclude your book with a call for women to participate more in young girls' comings of age. How can that manifest itself now?
Well, I think we need to talk about sexual ethics in a post-virginal world. And yet it's a very hard thing to do. I'm the mother of two granddaughters, teenage girls, and I think to myself, in principle and theory, wouldn't it be nice if I could share? It's not so much I want to tell about my sexual experiences, but it's clear to me that younger women and girls, I've seen this in my classroom, they like to know about the experience of other generations of women.
Mm-hmm.
They like to hear some of women's acquired wisdom and experience in dealing with intimate relationships. And that means these days heterosexual relationships as well as homosexual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to have some principles about what's fair, what's equitable, what kinds of symmetry girls should expect in an intimate relationship. Because right now we're faced with a situation where there's a lot of information out there about middle school girls being drawn into oral sex with boys. They don't understand what they're doing. There is little pleasure for them. The boys are in control. The new mandate with sexuality, some of which I applaud, which is allow yourself to be a sexual human being at a relatively earlier age than in my generation.
Mm-hmm.
That's great, but there are risks in it.
Yeah.
And so you can't just, say, go girl, and allow girls to think that flaunting their sexuality or that their sexuality is their only source of power.
Right.
So there are some real dangers and struggles around these issues that I don't think we have yet come to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And women's bodies are used to sell almost everything still.
Everything.
The feminist movement, the second wave of the feminist movement,
everything.
We thought we were making big changes.
No, I don't think we're disappointed.
I certainly am.
Yeah. So. I think that's why there's... there are a lot of books about this. I mean, Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth, My Stuff, Jean Kilbourne's wonderful film, Killing Us Softly.
Gilligan.
Yeah, Gilligan is about, Gilligan doesn't talk about sexuality that much, but about, the voice of women and girls. I mean, there has been in the past 20 years an enormous amount of attention to girls.
Mm-hmm.
Some sense that the feminist movement didn't do everything that we needed to do for younger girls, again, in this post-virginal world where our claims for our sexual voices have been recognized, but then what do we do in a culture that has not changed that much?
We seem to have dropped the ball once we went through the consciousness-raising groups. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that when I read your book, I was thinking maybe we should try to resurrect consciousness-raising groups for young girls.
Well, in some ways, that's what I'm saying in the Body Project, and I think that's one of the reasons why the book has resonated with a lot of women's studies programs and independent girls' schools and girls' programs like Girls Inc. Incorporated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get a lot of invitations to talk to those kinds of in those kinds of venues, and it's precisely because the issues are not resolved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you think you've opened up a an incredible sort of Pandora's box in regard to this issue, and it will carry on. Has this opened up a discussion in the culture?
Well, I'd like to think. I mean, I don't think it was just me. I think it was a lot of other people, too.
Yeah.
You know, again, I mean, Carol Gilligan, Mary Pfeiffer. I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, who are writing about girls. I think what's different about my work is that I take a historical perspective on how we got to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Don't blame it all on Calvin Klein. All right. Don't blame it all
on television
and media. Okay. Or, you know, misogynistic men who are trying to sell us, you know, drop waist jeans. I mean, all of those things are implicated in what's going on, but there's a lot more going on. And at some level, I guess I'm the person who said, let's take a look at the body projects themselves. Let's try to figure out their meaning and how much energy and money they are costing us, because this is an issue that every sane woman in our culture has to deal with. I'm going to take out sane. Let's say every woman in our culture has to deal with, because you have to make a decision. How invested am I going to be in this deep cultural imperative to beautify and to make myself perfect? And right now, the health and the beauty imperative have come together, you know, so that, let's say, slimness is, you know, a cultural virtue. And, you know, in that kind of environment, you know, more and more people, men as well as women, and younger as well as old, you know, we've got dieters at 8, and then we've got octogenarians who are dieting in the nursing homes. So,
are you surprised by that? Because you did write a groundbreaking book about anorexia. Are you surprised that things haven't gotten better since you started that awareness about anorexia many, many years ago? And
well,
it seems like
that's
the slimness thing
question.
Has gotten even worse.
Yeah, it has gotten worse.
Yeah.
It has gotten worse. Although the actual numbers of people with anorexia nervosa has not changed that much, but the number of bulimics has gone up. And there are more and more people presenting disordered eating as part of other psychopathologies. We use the appetite as a voice in this culture. We have so much food provided in so many easily accessible ways and formats, 24/7.
Yeah.
And then we also have this obesity epidemic going on, which is, you know, a strange and curious phenomenon also, because potato chips are cheaper than broccoli. So this is kind of a class phenomenon as well. We're kind of screwed up about the way we eat.
The Body Project has been made into a play, a musical.
No, well, there's music in it.
I heard that it was...
There's music in it,
but
it's kind of incidental
music. Okay.
You know, it's not music like in the Rodgers and Hammerstein sense where it advances the plot.
Uh-huh. So how did this come about? And this will obviously help to reach other audiences.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. Leslie Jacobson, who once lived in Ithaca, interestingly enough, is the chair of the Department of Theater at George Washington University and a playwright. And she's a white middle-class woman in her 50s. And she collaborated with a young African-American woman by the name of Vanessa North, who was her student at GW at one point. They had read The Body Project, and they came to me and they said, hey, what do you think about our doing a play based on the book? And it's not really based on the book. I think it's fair to say it's inspired by the book. I mean, my words are not in the play. It's not historical in any way. The subtitle of the play, the play is called The Body Project in All Shapes and Sizes. It premiered in Washington in October, ran for about 6 weeks, and it's going to travel. And I'm hoping that it's going to come to Ithaca. There's been some talk about that. You don't need a big venue. Something like the Kitchen would be great, Kitchen Theater.
And does it start a dialogue? Is that
I mean, it's very interesting. It has seven characters of different ages, ethnicities, and body shapes and sizes. And their lives are meshed in some interesting ways. The thing that unites them all is each of them, in one way or another, their life is being poisoned, if you will, by some kind of obsession that has to do with body projects and the preoccupation with appearance. So it's presented as kind of a toxicity issue for women. And, you know, there's an aging actress, actor, and there are some teenage scenes that are fantastic. The play says quite a bit about the relationship between body projects and sexuality and race. It's very interesting. And I did a talk back two nights in Washington after the performance, and I found people's interest in it to be, you know, pretty intense.
Yeah, I would think it would be another vehicle in which to reach a wider audience, or a different audience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the acting was superb. I was very surprised by the quality of the acting. Some of that, I understand, has to do with the fact that Horizons Theater, which is Leslie Jacobson's project, if you will, it's the oldest feminist theater in the country, and it's in Washington, D.C., and they're the people who did this, all right? When they do a call for actors, they get talent from New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, and even their casting is a little different. Their cast calls, they're not the kind of, you know, like meat market things, like, does she look the part? The actors are asked to comment on the play, and do they have a relationship to the issues in the play? They do improv. So I thought the people were extremely talented.
Is the body project also going to be made into a film? I've heard that.
Well, yeah, as we speak, I'm hoping that a legal contract has been signed.
And will this be directly about your book?
This will be more about my book. This will be a documentary film about the body project. And the ideas in the book, I imagine it will have some historical dimensions. I probably will do some photo research and stuff like that, historical stuff for the film. The production company is Wonderland Films in New York City, and I'm very fortunate that there's going to be a wonderful young feminist director by the name of Megan O'Hara, who hails from Syracuse, New York, and has worked with Michael Moore.
Oh, nice.
So
great.
I don't think she's going to tamp down
the
economic critique in the book.
Well, what else are you working on? Do you have any other books in the?
Well,
in the
I'm starting.
You don't want to
hard.
Talk about it. Right?
A little bit. Yeah, I'm interested in doing something that has to do with my own life. The fact that I'm a grandmother to two Ithaca girls, who are equestrians, both of them, and I'm very interested in that. You know, kind of crazy old question, what is there about girls and horses? And I don't think it's all about the horse as a sexual surrogate. So I'm trying to understand that relationship from the perspective of developmental psychology. In other words, what are all the things that girls actually do get from horseback riding? Autonomy, power, an opportunity to nurture, there's so many things. But I'm also interested in the history of American girls on horseback. When did all this start? You know, how did
Annie
the
Oakley.
Horse? Well, how did the horse become such an object of affection, and why did that happen as it lost its economic function? You know, on the family farm, and what are the vehicles for that? The reading, you know, everything from Black Beauty to Misty Maid to Chincoteague and National Velvet. So how does that relationship? How is that relationship embedded in American culture and society?
Well, we can look forward to that book. I hope it comes out soon. It sounds very interesting. We have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for your good questions.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.